Okay, let's start. Welcome back again for another installment of Finite State Machines. So last time I was talking about deterministic finite state systems. This time I want to talk about non-deterministic systems. And I also want to throw in a bit about structured design, how you start to build bigger finite state machines. As usual, what I want to do is to give you a little problem to think about at the beginning, and then we'll return to it at the end. And so the problem is actually one where I'll give you a bit of, assuming the timing works out in the lecture, I'll give you a little bit of time to think about it at the end, because I want you to do a tiny little bit of design for me before the end of the lecture. Here's the start of the problem. We'll come back to this at the end. So this is a real example. This is a sort of slightly, I'm afraid it's a slightly somber lecture this time, because these are the systems I'm encouraging to think about are systems where safety is an issue. So, and often that's true when you're trying to design things that involve the specification of, say, control systems with finite state machines. Those are a class of systems which is very important for that kind of technology. So here's a real example. And there are actually quite a few examples around this time in history, so to the 1980s. This was one I just chose at random from a bunch of examples. Japan Airlines Flight 350, it crashed short of the runway at Tokyo. What happened was, airplanes, all of you have flown in airplanes. To break an airplane, a jet aircraft, then you have reverse thrusters, which you normally operate. The aircraft lands, you feel the aircraft go boom, you hear a roar, it's the reverse thrusters. The reverse thrusters are pushing air in the opposite direction to slow you down, so you're not just relying on the aircraft's brakes, and therefore your aircraft slows nice and gracefully, and you're all safe. In this particular aircraft, I haven't gone into the details of why, because they're a little bit sordid. But in this particular case, this was actually intentional deployment of the reverse thrusters on the aircraft's engines. They're coming in. Pilot deploys the reverse thrusters. The aircraft is not on the ground. It breaks and it falls out of the sky, and everybody dies. So that's not good. So one way to actually fix this problem, which is actually following crashes like that, actually this sort of equipment was installed in aircraft. What you do is I'm simplifying a bit here, okay? But what you do is you put a sensor in the landing gear, and you can detect when the wheels are on the ground. Aircraft hits the ground, wheels start to spin, right? Wheels are going round. You can detect that with the sensor on the wheels. So And so then when you're in, so then you have a feedback from the sensor that says, prevents you from deploying the thrusters unless you're actually on the ground. And then this sort of thing is not going to happen.
So what we return to later is, suppose you had to build, you know, in a simple way, that particular little bit of control system, what you build, how would you specify it? We'll come back to that at the end.
Right. So, as usual, back before we get to that, we do a little bit of looking at the formal definition of things. So here's a non-deterministic finite state machine model. And this is this looks almost exactly like the definition you've seen before for the deterministic one. You have a set of states. One of those is identified as initial. It's just the same as before on your little diagram. One is the initial state. You have a set of input symbols. I'm just defining this for the acceptor finite state machine. You could also have output symbols if you have a finite state machine that's a transducer. You have an initial state, and you have a set of accepting states, which are a subset of all the states you have. And then the bit where it differs is in the transition relation. So instead of when you have a deterministic finite state machine, the transition relation identifies exactly one state that you can go to from every state. Remember, you were drawing up the transition table. The cells in the table say where you can go given what the current input is and what the current state is. And that's always a single state because it's deterministic. If it's a non-deterministic finite state machine, then that can have more than one. So it's a set of successor states in those cells in the table given the current state and the set of transitions. So that's the only difference. However, there are two types of non-determinism that we're going to use here. One you've seen before. So the first one, the one at the top, is where you have, and here I'm just reiterating what I said in the last lecture, I believe it was. One way you get non-determinism is you have a state. And with the same input symbol, you can get to more than one other state. That's the one at the top. So there, it's state number one. If you get the input A, you can go to either state number two or state number three. Or on the right there is another variant of it, where with the symbol A in state number one, you can either go back to state number one or go on to state number two. So you've seen that before. This is completely okay for you, I guess. This one down here you haven't seen before. So when you see that tiny little epsilon symbol, what that means is there's a transition, but no input occurred. In a sense, it was invisible. It's like having a way of teleporting you from one state to the other with no particular input. You can just move. Okay? Happy with that? So a little squiggle means you can just move. And so that also gives you that can also be used to give you a form of non-determinism, because from state number two, you can invisibly go to three, or you can go to four with B. Because you see in a moment why we need that second one. What you're thinking at the moment is, why on earth would we need this? Wait. I'll show you why you need it. Because okay. It's quite nice when you're doing designs of systems. Okay. So the next concept, I'm going to introduce one more concept in this lecture. And this concept is going to be important for the lecture that comes next. I want to talk about the language of a non-deterministic finite state machine. So quite often when you're talking about acceptor finite state machines, you say, what language does it accept? And in the next lecture, I'll be talking about a very compact way of talking about the language. And I'm not going to talk about that much in this lecture. All I want to do is just sensitize you to it a little bit. So this isn't important that you deeply understand this concept now, but it is important that I just introduce it. Okay. Given that you've got a finite state machine model of the sort that I described, and a string, which is in the language of that finite state machine model, in other words, where the language is all of the possible strings that you could be giving to that particular model, then accepts that particular string, the model, succeeds when there's a trace for that string ending in accepting state, right? That's just reiterating something I said before. You define your model. It accepts a string that you've given it, the x here in this formal definition, if you can find a path from the start state to the accepting state in that model. Remember, the accepting states were the ones that we identified with a double circle.
right? So it's just finding a path. Okay. So then the language of that finite state model, which I'll write down as LM. I'm sorry, I'm unable to point at this because my little... Oh, I can. It's just enough battery left. Okay. I thought I'd run out. So the, oh, which I have, actually. It's just, okay, so I just have to point. So the LM there is the language of that state machine. It's the set of strings and all of the possible strings that you could have with the symbols that you've got, such that it accepts it. All the paths that you could have in your finite state machine, given the alphabet that you're working with. Okay, that's what that is. And for any language, we call it a regular language if there's a finite state machine for it. Okay, we'll come back to that particular concept later. Okay? So all I've done is introduce the... All I've done is, at the moment, introduce to you the idea of the language of a finite state machine, which is something that you can just abstract. You just think of it as being all the traces that that finite state machine will be able to produce. Okay, so now back to the non-deterministic finite state machine. Here's an example of one. So the diagram at the top is finite state machine. So now you're familiar with this notation. I don't need to you can look at one of those now, and I don't need to explain to you how that works, right? Yeah. Completely happy, looks good, yeah, okay. Some people aren't looking just too tremendously happy. Let me just step through that one just to remind you what the notation is. The arrow at the beginning into state zero is the initial state. You know it's the initial state because there's an arrow just coming into it from nowhere. There'll be exactly one of these. At the other end, state number three has two circles around it. That means it's an acceptor state. And there happens to be only one of those in this finite state machine, but there could be as many as makes sense for your state machine. And all the others are intermediate states. And then, of course, the arcs are labeled with the inputs. Actually, just to remind you about a convention here, if I write something, when I'm writing something like this on an arc, on the acceptors, that A, typically for acceptor finite state machines, they only take inputs, so I don't have to show you what the output might be on the arc. If it was a transducer finite state machine, where on an arc there can be either an input or an output, then typically people write this, with a slash. So it's just a convention. So that particular arrow between two states would say A is input and B is output. Okay. So for the moment, I'm talking about acceptor finite state machines, where I don't need to bother about making this distinction. It's always an input, because it's pulling a symbol off the input stream. Okay. So these are all inputs. And say, for example, for state 0, then what you can do from state 0 is either, if you get an A, you either continue at state 0 or you go to 1, or if you get a B, you continue at state 0, for example. So then it accepts strings over the alphabet A and B, and you can see what it does. It accepts any string over A and B that ends in ABA. Right? That's what that state machine does. And you can easily see it looking at it, right? Because there's a cycle that chews up all of your alphabet, and the only way you get to an acceptor is to get to ABA. So there's your formal definition. There are four states, 0, 1, 2, 3. The alphabet is AB. The initial state is 0. There's a single accepting state, which is 3. And your transition table, the delta there, looks like that. So let me take two cells in the table. So it's state 0, so that's the column, top column. Then if you get input A, then the states that you can go to are 0 and 1. You can inspect the table and you can see that that's true. At state 2, then if you get input A, you can go to exactly 3. Okay. And some of the cells in that table are empty. So remember in a previous lecture I was saying that if you have states that would not lead to an acceptor state, you have some choices. You can either have a trap state, so you invent a new state where it would just cycle with any alphabet and never get to an acceptor, which makes these diagrams rather cumbersome, or you just don't have the transition. You leave it out. Okay. And so if there is no transition, it won't get to an acceptor state, the question.
Doesn't this need to implement tracking to know when it has exactly three characters?
Yes. So the issue. So that I think the question you're asking is a reasonable question. How do you know? So if you were at zero, and you get the character A, how do you know whether to continue at zero or whether to go on to state number one? Because you haven't seen the other B or the A yet. That's your question, really. This comes back to a question that somebody asked at least either the last lecture or the lecture before. Was saying it was you, was it? Yeah, right. I can hear you. You're going to be the troublemaker. It's how do you make the choice, basically? It's non-deterministic. How do you choose? And my answer was, if you remember, it's a process of magic, which is a great answer to give. The reason I give this particular example here is because it really shows this off. Because it is a really elegant way of writing this, right? I couldn't really think of a more elegant way of writing finite state machine with strings that end in that particular sequence. But the trouble is, it depends on you being able to spot that you should go down that road. Right? And for a moment, let's give it as a process of magic. Mm.
Yeah, I think we can solve this if we have a transition from 1, if it gets an A again to 0, and from 2, if it gets a B again to 0.
Yeah, or you could take that thing and just turn it into a deterministic finite state machine. That would be the other thing that you could try to do. But let's not do that here. Let's not do that. You could do that. And I believe in tutorials, you get to play around with this. So wait for the tutorial, and then you can do this. Okay, remember this one? We had fun with this one last time. and I've changed the definition down there. I think that's maybe right. So remember this one? I wish this pointer could work a little bit. So you have three acceptor states. You get a 0, then you're still in an acceptor state, but you need a 1 to continue in an acceptor state. Other way around for 1s and 0s. If you get a couple of 0s, then you end up in a trap state, right? So we were through this one last time. Let's not unpack it again. So that's a deterministic finite state machine. So the issue is, what's that like? Is a non-deterministic one? Here's a non-deterministic one that I believe is doing the same thing. And you might think of other variants of this, but I would claim it's an easier one to look at and understand. So here you go. So the reason for let me tell you why I'm giving you this one. I'm not just gratuitously giving you more finite state machines. I want to start to talk a little bit about how you build them up compositionally from atomic components. And so we're kind of moving towards that. So in some ways, this particular example doesn't matter. I'm just kind of moving you towards where I want you to be. So here are your acceptor states. This damn thing doesn't work well. Maybe this would work better. Can I do this? Yes. Okay. So here are your acceptor states. You have the initial one, which is an acceptor as before. And here's one where you've got one, and then you're allowed to get as actually shouldn't that be? You have to have no more than one. Okay. Oh, I think it's okay. Okay. So here's the bit where you've got a single one. You've got an acceptor state, and then you can go from 0 to another acceptor state. Of course, you'll be saying you don't need all of these little invisible transitions, and it's true you don't. But bear with me, you'll see in a moment why they're there to show you how you can compositionally build things up. So all these are invisible, so you can just go there. So from here, you can go to here invisibly, or you can go to here. This bit is really just expressing that I've got a 1, and then I've got a 0 that gets me somewhere else. This one is expressing that I've got a single 0, and then I can get a 1, and I go to somewhere else. And this one is saying I can go in either of these directions. So this is like an OR. Think of this like an OR. And think of these as like an AND. So what I'm really doing is I'm thinking of the AND and then composing it with an OR. And in a moment I'm going to give you general rules for doing this. This is where I'm going. So the AND bit is I've got a 1, then I want to get a 0. The other AND bit is I've got a 0, then I want to get a 1 after it. That's what I'm trying to express here. And then the orbit is saying either one is okay. Okay, either path is okay. And so those are the two concepts I'm working with. And they're kind of nice, clean concepts. I can think of that separately. A 1, then a 0. 0, then I want to get a 1. And then I just want to be able to compose those
And this OR is allowing me to compose it. And all these invisible things are just enabling me to do the composition. Yes?
Can you go both ways? Is it an exclusive OR?
You can go either way. You can go either way. So it's so
it's not an exclusive OR because you could take, you could make either choice. You don't want to think about it that way. However, you also don't want to think of it quite like a logical OR, but that's getting a bit, no. So basically just think of it as a fork in the road. You have a fork in the road when you're doing, all you're looking for here are traces through your finite state machines. You have a fork in the road and you're allowed to take either path because it's non-deterministic, and in this case, either path invisibly with nothing necessarily happening. Here, things are happening. You've got a one, you've got a zero, you've got a zero, you've got a one. Okay, so for now, all I want to do is to show it. And so if you drew a transition table for that, it would look like that. Okay, and you can go back through, you've got the slides, you can go back through and check that out. Okay? Okay, so now's the bit I really want it to get to. This is the bit I want you to, because you'll need it a little bit for later on. I want to talk to you a little bit about structured design. So there's about three slides that I'm going to dwell on for a bit, and then we'll get to the example where you get to do a bit of thinking. Okay? So you want to do structured design, and sort of I was edging towards that in the last finite state machine, but now we want to do it in a methodical way. So there's various kinds of structures that you might want to put in. Here's the first one, which is just sequence. Suppose I have a finite state machine M1, and I don't care what the structure of it is. It can be any kind of structure you like, as long as it's a legitimate finite state machine, non-deterministic. And I want to join that up in sequence with finite state machine M2, right? So I'll write that M1, M2. Okay. Don't worry too much about the way I'm writing this for the moment, because in the next lecture we'll come back to that. And what I want that to do is I want it to be able to accept the language of that consists of the sequences accepted by M1, all of those, followed by the ones accepted by M2. So if a finite state machine M1 accepted, let's say, only the character A, and finite state machine M2 accepted only the character B, then the one that's composed would accept only the sequence AB, right? Or if finite state machine 1 accepted the sequences AB, BA, and finite state machine 2 accepted only the sequences, I don't know, CD, DC or something, then the composition of those two would accept A, B, C, D, oh Christ, B, A, C, D, A, B, D, C, A, B, whatever, D, D, C, or whatever, you know, the combinations. You get four combinations out of those, right? Got that? Did I explain that well? Sort of-ish, right? Good enough. Right, we're taking the two, we want to be able to get all the traces that place the FSMs in sequence. Okay, and the way you do that is very simple. Here is where you really like these invisible transitions, because it allows you to compose. So, suppose since, I should have said, the other thing that I'm going to require us to have is there to be a distinguishable start point in M1 and a distinguishable end point in M2, a single one, right? So suppose we have that, so there's where M1 starts and there's where it ends, okay? And then whatever happens in between, I've drawn a single transition here, but it could be any damn thing that's in between. Same for M2. And this little egg-shaped circle around them is just showing you that that's the whole of that big, complex, finite state machine. And all I do is I take the starts and the ends and I join them together. That's it, right? So whatever was the end point of M1 becomes the start point of M2. Whatever was the end point of M2 becomes the end state. And I have a beginning state that's the beginning point of M1. And invisibly, you can move. Happy with that? Question?
So can we say that basically the output of M1 will be the input of M2?
That's a way of thinking about it, yes. You're just chaining them together. And since each finite state machine has been, we assume, has been designed such that it is an acceptor for the language for that finite state machine, and sticking the finite state machines together so that, as you put it, the output is the input of the other of the one in succession, is going to give you all the sequences that concatenate together. Right? Happy with that? If you feel that that's a little bit iffy, just try it with two, you know, the simplest finite state machines you can think of, join them together just exactly this way and see what happens. You know, go through the traces and you'll find that they're preserved. Okay, so that's the first one and the easiest one. Very important you understand this first one. Everybody happy with that? Good. So the next one is where you've got choice. Okay, so the first one was a bit like in the diagram I gave you before with the zeros and ones, where you had the and. A question.
If the last one could have multiple initial states for M2?
I'm hesitating. You can tell because I'm going, yeah, that's why I do when I'm hesitating. I think it could. But then it's going to make it harder for you to think about the composition. I think if you were going to, the reason I'm hesitating is not because I think that's a bad idea, but because I think it's easier for people to do the compositions, because you can always invent inside M2 something that was the state that connected to those multiple states, right? So I think it's very much easier to think about it as something where you can identify the individual ones. It's just simpler to think about it that way. But there's a wider point that you just raised. For all of these, what I'm giving you is a method by which you can do the composition. As a consequence, you will have a whole lot of these invisible transitions in the finite state machines that you produce. And you will, over time, you will be able to look at those and you'll think, actually, that looks horrible. It's bristling with invisible transitions. We must make it simpler. And which you will be able to do. You'll be able to get rid of a lot of those. And one way would be the way that you describe for certain kinds of problems. Okay, so choice is like this. So there, for choice, exactly the same as before. Here's M1. You want M1 or M2. I'm going to use this symbol later where I'm talking about choice. Don't worry about it too much for now. I'm just showing you the symbol. So what I want is the language that's accepted by M1 or M2. So if M1 did AB and M2 did CD, then I want a finite state machine that accepted AB or CD. Right? That's what I'd want. Right? And so the way you do that is, again, you can see the set. This is a pattern that I've already used in the example I gave you before. Here's M1, as complex as you want it to be. So it can have all sorts of structure inside it, sequence and choice and whatever inside it. Here's M2, it has whatever, but it's got a start state and an end state. I join them together, and I have a new start and end state. This one allows me to go through this path or this path. This one joins them together.
So you're going through either one, but what I end up, sorry, I keep forgetting you're viewing this way, so I have to do it the opposite. I start over here with that newly invented beginning state. I will end at the newly invented end state, but I could have gone either way through the FSMs, therefore I will have an OR.
I don't really understand this, the epsilon thing, right? If you asked a computer to do that, would it just choose randomly a path to go down?
Think of it as choosing randomly, and you're in this wonderful position that for any particular string that you've got, you can magically know what the right choice would be. So the issue, for us looking at a non-deterministic finite state machine, we just assume that something will choose the right path. One way of choosing the right path would be to convert it into deterministic finite state machine, but let's not go there at the moment. Okay, last one I'm going to give you is a new operator, which is the star operator, which you'll see later, which is a particular character sequence repeated 0 or more times. So if I have a finite state machine that recognizes the sequence AB, for example, if I want something that represents that can recognize AB 0 more times, then that particular finite state machine is going to give me empty sequence or AB or AB AB or AB 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 and so on, right? So that sets the language. So that's that defined there. Okay, and this is a little bit more complicated, but it's not that bad. So here's your finite state machine originally. So this is M. It can be going from here to here can be as complicated as you like.
but it's got the distinguished start point, the distinguished end point. And then what we're doing is we can go back. So that's the cycling around bit that allows me to give whatever was the sequence for n as many times as I like. Or I can go from the beginning straight to the end without doing anything. That's a zero. So here's zero or more times. Last node to
In the same way that the lower bit is done, the transition from the first one to the other.
Oh, you mean going back here?
Yeah. That mean the same thing as
that wouldn't make any practical difference. Would it? What would that do for you that I haven't already done?
That's what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah. I don't think that would make any practical difference because that just enables me to get back to somewhere I've been, and I already have a way of getting back to somewhere I've been. And then this particular one, okay? So all I wanted to do is give you those. You get some practice of using those in the tutorials. The reason why I'm harping on about this is because you'll find it very useful when somebody asks you to build a more complicated finite state machine. There's two ways you can do it. Somebody says, build me a finite state machine for X. And maybe it's a very simple type of problem, and you can just see exactly what it should be. Or you're incredibly clever at thinking about finite state machines. Somehow your brain is wired that way, and you can see exactly what it is. Good, that's great. If you can't, then you're going to have to do it step by step. Just like in building programs, you want something that is modular. And so what I'm really giving you is a modular way of doing that. If you can decompose the problem into saying, okay, this bit of the problem, I need to do this bit of control. And then I need to compose it with this other bit of the problem that I've got. It allows you to build bit by bit, understanding the finite state machine you've got, freezing it and then building it with others. The result may be a little more complex because it will have some of these empty transitions. Actually, sometimes that complexity is beneficial because you can still see the modularity of the design. Okay, so rather than everything being composed in some clever way. So there's all sorts of decisions there. Okay, so we're nearly at the end here. And I did want to give you a little bit of time to think. So here's the problem. I'm going to give you... I'll give you some. So imagine you're trying to build. What I'm going to do is give you about 5 minutes. Read my mail on my iPhone or something while you're doing this. I just want to give you a tiny bit of practice, just in writing a little finite state machine for yourself. You see in a moment there is a really serious point at the back of this, which we'll get onto at the very end if we have time. Okay, so I'll give you some inputs and some outputs you can expect from this system, just to kind of standardize it a little bit, because you can invent all sorts of complicated things. I don't want you to go completely nuts over this. So I'll give you some inputs. Here are some inputs. One is that the pilot... I hope you can read my... If you can't read my writing, then just remember and write it down yourself or something like that. One is the pilot activates the thruster. Okay? So pilot activates thruster can be an input to your finite state machine, right? That's a pilot activates the thruster. Presses or does whatever it is that pilots do to activate thrusters. I mean... Do understand, I am simplifying this an awful lot. I don't understand very much about aircraft control systems. Never worked on. Okay. Another one that the pilot can do, let's say, is you can have the manual override. That's the button that the pilot's going to press when you want to be able to override and switch off the thrusters. Switch them off, for God's sake, because you have to have a manual override, okay? Okay, so those are inputs that the human can give to your system. Here's a couple of inputs that other parts of the system can give to your system. One is that it's on the ground. I cannot believe that you can actually really read this, actually. It's very, very, very difficult. This board is terrible, I'm sorry. That says on ground. You write down whatever you want. I mean, so it's the concepts that are important. The other thing that the system can give to you is
Let's say you want to keep, just to make it a little bit more complex, you want to be able to keep, not to switch off the thrusters unless they're overridden until you've got to taxi speed. Okay? So you want to have something that says, there's a signal that says, actually with my handwriting you probably couldn't read it even if it was a brilliant board. You want to have something that, a signal that says, we've reached taxi speed. You know, something that's monitoring the wheels or something can tell how fast you're going. Okay? So those are the inputs you can have. You have four. Pilot activates the thruster. Pilot activates the manual override. Or from the system. System can say, you're on the ground, because it's monitoring, right, importantly, it's monitoring the wheels, whether the wheels are spinning or not. When you're flying, they're not. When you're on the ground, they are. Or you have a signal saying, we're at taxi speed. They're now going slow enough. Now you have two outputs. Your two outputs are activate the thruster, and another one is deactivate. Thruster. So those are the two outputs. Switch it on, switch it off. I know life is more complicated than this, but we're trying to get through this in 5 minutes. Right. Okay.
Do we have switch off? Does the pilot have switch off just manually at taxi speed?
Oh no, these are signals given by your control system to switch off the thruster. So these are outputs. You're designing a little control system that's going to sit in the airplane somewhere, and it's going to receive signals from two sources. Pilot, that's these two buttons. Activate the thruster, override, so the thruster switches off, just in case. And then the only outputs from your system are outputs that it's giving to the thruster. Switch it on, switch it off. Right? So I'll leave you, that's enough of a specification. I'll leave you to think about that until, how much time have we got? Well, I'll try and finish at 5:02, and I do want to say a little bit about this, so say by about 10:02, just to think about it.
For manual override, can you switch
it off? No, it's just off for this. Otherwise, it gets too complicated for you to think about. And I just want a simple little system, just to give you to think about this. Okay? And the aim of this is, if you find this difficult to think about, do not worry. Because later you're going to get practice in tutorials. I'm going to do an entire lecture talking about systems design connected with this. We'll be going over it again. I'm really doing this to make a different point, actually, at the end. But I do want you to think about it.
The activate and deactivate, they are outputs here.
How do you mean?
Is it strictly for activating the booster?
Yes, so you press the button that says, yeah, that's the one where the pilot says, I want to activate them. I know life in fact is more complicated, but assume that for this. I'm going to call a halt to it just in a moment. I can always tell when it's a good idea to call a halt. You start to hear murmurings, and people are talking about their lunch or something. Oh, is that one at the back?
On the switch, how would
be? Sorry? sorry, could you share it? You're too far.
On the slide, where it says, that might be unintentional.
Oh, actually, I see what you mean. That's why I didn't want to get into it, actually, because I don't like talking about it. It actually was intentional. It was a suicide attempt, I believe, by the pilot.
Oh, okay.
Unintentional would also be a possibility, yeah. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it wasn't. Allegedly. Okay, so now you had a chance to think. All I really wanted you to do was to have a chance just to think about that problem, because it's the sort of thing that occupied, right, after crashes like this, this was the sort of thing that occupied people's minds. You can imagine in people building these kind of design systems, they got occupied about topics like this. And so what you have is a bunch of engineers, just like what you're doing here, except you're doing it in 5 minutes, and people are doing it much more seriously. They're thinking, how can we make that system safer? Right? They really would like, and what they want to do is to stop stuff like this happening by being good engineers. And so actually, they design systems like that. So probably you wrote, I'm guessing, we don't have time to go through all of the designs. You can think about it yourself. Probably you wrote something that had something like this in it. It doesn't have to be exactly like this, and it could have had more cycles. So there could be cycles where it's, you know, taking more measurements and all of this sort of stuff, or it's more complicated. But probably it's a little bit like this, right? I'm not a million miles away from what you wrote, probably. Yeah, right? So you have something where you have a starting state, and the pilot can activate the thruster, and then you have another input that's checking whether you're on the ground, and if you get to here, then you can actually send a signal to activate the thruster. And this state is when the thruster is off, this state is when the thruster is on. And then if you reach taxi speed, then you can deactivate the thruster. If you get manual override, you immediately send the signal to deactivate the thruster. Or you could make it more complicated. Or maybe I got it slightly wrong and you have a better version or something. But anyway, so my question to you is, how do you feel about that? Imagine you were building this. Happy to build that kind of system? Good thing to do, right? You've been on the bunches of engineers doing that, you built that system. You'd have killed people. So here's another aircraft crash, this time in 93. This is in Warsaw. You can read it. Is it a moment to read it? So I'm doing this a little bit for effect. Of course, people who are doing this always, just like you are trying to do the right thing, trying to build the system. You're building in the control structures in order to tackle a problem with a system that you've got. Absolutely right. You did the right thing. You know, I could do no better. Neither could the assembled engineers working on systems like this for aircraft. But here we are. Warsaw, 93, quite a few years later, was flying with one of those systems installed. Remember early on I was talking about boundary problems when you're building your system. What is it that you include in the design of your system? There was an important feature of actual flight that these guys hadn't considered. For this particular flight, it's coming down in Warsaw. It's very important that it's September. It's late in the year. I don't know if the people from Warsaw here get quite cold and windy in Warsaw in September, but like Edinburgh in some ways. They're coming in. The runway's a bit slippery. There's the wind is not very good. There's a bit of a strong tailwind when they're coming in. So strong tailwind, runway slippery, the sensors on the wheels aren't turning fast enough. The signal isn't signaling. Right? So the airplane thinks that the airplane is still flying. It's not. It's on the runway. And it was in that state for about 9 seconds. 9 seconds is too long. 9 seconds is long enough for you not to be able to brake. And so therefore, your plane crashes. Sometimes you have to make this decision.
That's not technically a fault in the equipment
pilot doing the wrong thing making.
But now having given you this information, I'll bet, if you're not now, you will be by the time you graduate, smart enough to design a system that wouldn't have this problem either. You could do it. You could build a system that doesn't have this problem either. This is always true. So this is my point. This is always true. You will always find another problem when you're trying to build safe systems. Secure systems is another good example. You will always find somebody who comes along, just like I did to you right now, with another problem that gives you a different feature of the environment in which you have to work that shows you how you can either circumvent in terms of things like security, you will have yet another lethality that you never thought of, possibly emerging from the design of the thing that you did to fix the first one. You will be in circumstances, possibly even overtly, where maybe you even have to be part of a decision. Are we going to have this many deaths or this many deaths? Deciding whether I build a system this way or that way. I told you it would be a bit of a kind of somber lecture. It's not really somber because this is true for any system, right? Probably it's true for architects building buildings, right? But it's certainly true for us. And you never want to really lose sight of that when you're doing the maths. Most of what I do is just doing the maths, basic maths. But every now and again, I'll just flag those things up for you. Don't worry about it. Go out smiling, but be aware that these are issues that you have to deal with. Thank you very much. Oh, that one I didn't put online, but more or less you've got it. I mean, all you need at the end is this arrow goes this way, and that's manual override, and it deactivates the thruster, and that's the other way, and it deactivates the thruster. And you've got it. Bye.
Get the next one. Mm-hmm. I kind of imagine you can think of the state as being is running according to the uncertainty principle, like in quantum mechanics. Because until you get the next input, you can't really tell where it can go. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I think. Don't get too hung up on it, actually, because the thing is. Imagine you're doing this. Mostly systems are engineered systems. Imagine you're doing this. Then the reason why non-deterministic finite state machines are sometimes very